This is Solartopia Fight Back with Bob Fetrakis and Connie Goodell Newton. Today we have guests who attended the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. Our guests are Meg, Stephanie, and Charlie. And Bob also went to the U.S. Social Forum.
Except I'm not a guest. I'm in the co-host chair. But we have guests, and they were there! Oh, I was there too, but I wasn't organizing it, and a different perspective, perhaps.
So would you guys like to introduce yourself and just kind of say what you did at the U.S. Social Forum, what you enjoyed about it, and I'm also very curious about the organizational structure of the U.S. Social Forum, because I know that it was very large. How many people were there?
Around 20,000 people ended up showing up in Detroit. It was actually the largest social justice gathering Detroit has had.
Okay. So what is the U.S. Social Forum? What's the purpose of it, and what is it in response to?
So the U.S. Social Forum comes out of a 10-year tradition of the World Social Forum, which was started as a reaction to the World Economic Forum and the G8 summits. Margaret Thatcher had a very famous quote that there is no alternative to global neoliberalism, and the Global South and the Poor People's Movements said, actually, yes, there is. Another world is possible, and we can show it to you. And so for the past 10 years, we've been organizing internationally around the World Social Forums. And the international community has been asking for the past several years, where is the U.S. and having a domestic version? You all are all the belly of the beast, and the decisions that you all make in the U.S. really affect us here. And so this is our second U.S. social forum.
Great. So being so large that there were 20,000 people there, and I know that there were a lot of poor people. I know that the Poor People's March went through Columbus, Ohio. What were some of the things that organizers of the social forum did to kind of take care of everybody? What did people in Columbus do?
We were all actually part of a coalition of people to get to fundraise and get all of the folks from Columbus to safely get there without having to provide for themselves the transportation, the food, the fee to go to the forum and things along that line. So we had about a couple to a few months of planning up until the social forum, and we had a lot of different events. And when the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign came through, we set up a week of events around their visit and did some fundraisers and things like that. So they really heavily contributed to our being able to afford to all go up to the forum, so that was really good.
What did you all talk about in workshops, and what are your plans, I guess, for the future in organizing, or what plans came out of this year's social forum for economic justice in the United States as it relates to the international community?
I mean, there were, like, literally, like, 80 workshops going on at the same time, so it was kind of hard to, like, pick one workshop that you wanted to go to. I did a lot around my particular interest was in, like, building community alternatives to sexual assault. I was really excited by Philly Stands Up, had a really great workshop that was kind of like a baby People's Movement Assembly of people that were interested in finding alternatives to the police when dealing with sexual assault and doing, like, accountability processes with abusers in our community. That was the most exciting part of it to me, though I also am interested in, like, the squatters movements that are happening. I took part in some workshops with, like, Picture the Homeless based out of New York, and they basically, like, aggressively squat buildings and help move families in and protect the families.
Great.
And I think that's with all the foreclosures going on in the United States and, like, looking around at Detroit and how, like, probably 4/5 of the buildings there are abandoned, like, squatters movements and people reclaiming public property or private property and making it public. It's really important.
One of the People's Movement assemblies that I got to attend, which was really, really amazing, was the Prison Justice, and I say that with parentheses here, because it's not really about justice. The prison system isn't really about justice. So I went to the Prison Justice People's Movement Assembly, which was probably about over 100 people in one room gathering together from hundreds of different organizations all around the country, and we would come together and talk about how we can personally and with our communities and within our own states, how we can change the face of the way that we work with the prison industrial complex in our own communities. And the first thing that we kind of broke out and talked about was how each community is organizing around it right now. And a lot of people were having had a lot of great insight, and they told us their successes and told us how we can kind of get our foot off the ground with that kind of organizing. And it was an amazing thing because there were people who were prison abolitionists, people who don't want prisons around because of how they aren't really doing any justice, and they are just really
putting people in cages.
putting people in cages, essentially, and it's just a big vicious cycle of racism and putting people in cages, essentially. But so that was an amazing experience to get into a large conference room with that many people and having different breakout sessions where we kind of worked around creating our own solutions to addressing these problems instead of using the police systems that currently exist that are blatantly racist and classist and whatnot. So that was a really great experience for me, and I know a lot of my friends, because I mean, I came home with literally like pages and pages of notes of things that I took from it, things that I learned from different community organizations who've had success before in their organizing. So that was something that I and some of my friends who got to participate in that really benefited from. And at the end of the People's Movement Assembly, which was like one of the larger like umbrellas of the organizing in the social forum, like what the workshops were centered around, the People's Movement Assembly, at the end we had a list of things that we were going to take to our communities and things that we all agreed upon at the end. And it was really amazing to see people from a whole boatload of different backgrounds and different experiences come together and really have sort of like a unified idea of like what the people's solution to the prison industrial complex really is, or what it really looks like for the left in America in addressing the prison industrial complex. So.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really a part of, like, that is the concrete aspect of the social forum, right? I mean, like, those pieces, those resolutions are really that other world that is possible, which is really exciting. People aren't just going to talk in, like, lofty theory ideas. They're coming together and saying, because these conditions exist, and because these opportunities are possible, we're taking these actions. And those actions were those resolutions that Meg was just talking about. So we're moving forward on that other world. We're walking down that path.
Great.
Which is really exciting.
Great.
It was really fun because like the social forum as a whole was gigantic. There was over 1,500 workshops throughout the week. And they were categorized in roughly about 16 different brackets. So some focusing like on the capitalism and post-capitalist economics, some focusing like, you know, on restorative justice programs, some focusing specifically on prisons. And I went specifically with a focus of like a white anti-racist organizing lens. I'm a part of a national white anti-racist group, U.S. for All of Us, No Room for Racism, which is responding to people of color saying, hey, white folks, like this Tea Party thing is building up faster and faster. The prison systems continue to build up faster and faster. Where are you? And we looked around, we're like, we're really absent. And we're making a commitment to step forward and be those allies. And really taking direction from even back in the day of SNCC, when they the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, when they asked white folks to go back and work in their own communities and make room for people of color movements to grow. And we're still coming in from that same tradition of recognizing that white folks need to go work with other white folks who we have relationships with and tear down both interpersonal and institutional racism. So I spent a lot of time doing workshops around those issues.
So I think the three of you all traveled together kind of in a group, and Bob and Harvey also went to the U.S. Social Forum. So what was your experience going there? I mean, you gave a couple talks, so where did you stay? What workshops did you like?
Well, I went to the last Social Forum in Atlanta, and since Detroit's my hometown and they're turning my neighborhood into a meadow and orchard, which plays a good use for it, on the west side of the city.
Wow.
It was interesting. I lived both on the west side of the city and the east side of the city. In the 1980s, during the crack epidemic, courtesy of the CIA, I lived in a political commune over off East Gratiot. So I went up with Harvey and Pete Johnson with the Free Press, and we were at Woodward Academy. Literally, we were in a stairwell, but it was cool. It was sort of,
yeah.
You know, there was a lot of workshops going on. So,
right.
And, you know, and most of them I wish I could have attended. Ours really dealt with the question of private contractors secretly counting our vote, which I know it works well with the CIA in the third world when you want to rig elections. I'm just always stunned that people in the United States would allow private companies directly tied to the security industrial complex to count their vote with secret software. So we were going over the history of 2004 and the history of rigging elections in the country. And we hooked up with Detroit activists, particularly people with a systemic analysis of disinvesting in Detroit. Detroit is now under the sway of a mayor, a former NBA guy, who won in a surprising upset. But corporate Detroit loves him, Dave Bing. I used to like him when he was a Detroit Piston. I don't like him now that he's the mayor. But what they're doing, and we then later went into another workshop the next day with people from Detroit. And what you're seeing in Detroit is patterns of investment and disinvestment, which is really the looting of the people's asset. Cobo Arena, which, you know, they've put hundreds of millions of dollars to and is right on the river, they're now attempting to give away all of these assets.
Wow.
And the way it works is sort of like you go, well, the people in Detroit are so poor, they can't really afford their own art museum. So a nonprofit should take it over. Now, the paintings, which belong to the people, are literally worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Diego Rivera,
yeah.
Murals on the inside, massive paint. So the way it works is you get a nonprofit to take it over for the city of Detroit, and eventually the paintings will come up missing, as they always do,
okay.
And you'll loot the assets, right? And they evaluated Cobo Arena as a minus $300 million. So they want to give it to the two affluent white communities, Macomb County and Oakland County, because the people in Detroit, you know, that's right on the riverfront, right? They don't want to value the land, which is probably worth $100 million. And it's always under the guise of bringing in nonprofits or regional authorities, which usually means you merge with the two affluent white communities, Macomb County to the north and really Oakland County, and then they outvote Wayne County. So what you're seeing in Detroit is nothing more than the direct looting of what once was the richest city on earth, and it's all done under the guise of Detroit can't handle its own affairs. And you've also got the mayor who's going in there and giving away valuable property to that city. And part of it is me explaining the history. If you go downtown Detroit, you can take a people mover around the downtown of the city. But they never built a subway to the suburbs where the jobs were because people didn't want black people coming out in that area. So they gave $100 million worth of land away to Max Fisher, the Max Fisher School of Business. Then they built the Renaissance Center in Greektown and the casinos and the stadium. So you can circle Detroit without ever setting foot on a Detroit city. You can just take the people mover, which hires like six black guards, and circle the city and live in a luxury apartment, work at the rent center, go to the casinos, go to the ball games, go to Greektown and eat without ever setting foot on a real city street.
Wait, so the people mover, is that a move-in sidewalk?
It's like a giant L. It's a giant L that does nothing but loop around the riverfront, which really is for affluent white people.
So it's a, who have been, it a train?
Yeah, it's train? Like Chicago. It's like an L.
Okay.
It's an elevated, but it goes nowhere. It
okay.
loops the downtown. It should have went right up Woodward to the suburbs so people could actually, in Detroit, get
right.
jobs.
So I guess my question, coming out of your talk and just hearing what's going on with the nonprofits, I guess it seems to me like one of the greatest problems in the United States right now is privatization of government functions.
Sure.
Once they loot it all and steal, they'll give it back. The schools are being privatized,
sure.
The vote counting, the democracy is being mm-hmm. privatized, the prisons, and it's a huge problem because it's putting the power in the hand of private corporations. And now you're also talking about nonprofit corporations kind of making out on public public wealth.
Yeah, if you're going to sell a really bad idea, it, like the deconcentration of poor communities here, you're always going to want to turn it over to a nonprofit.
A nonprofit, because it looks a little bit less suspect that they're not making money off of it.
And the question is where those nonprofits get their money. You know, who is in fact backing them and who's giving them the money to do things that are vicious and socially
nasty. People still get paid when they're in nonprofits.
Sure.
This is WCRS Fight Back with Bob Fitrakis and Connie Goodell Newton.
All right. When I'm thinking about the social forum, I think the most optimistic thing for me was not only the diversity, but the amount of young people who were there, having gone to, you know, the left forums and the Socialist Scholars Conference over the years. I was very impressed at the amount of young people that were organizing the event and they were participating, and I saw that as a huge, huge breakthrough.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that really a lot of the youth movement is really inspired by intergenerational relationships and intergenerational mentorships. I read this amazing essay by Paul Kivel, who started the Oakland Men's Project back in the 70s, doing male solidarity with the feminist movement in the 70s. He recently wrote an essay to his generation, the 70s and 60s generation, saying, "Are you mentoring for social justice?" Recognizing that the youth culture, folks in my generation in the mid-20s or in younger, really were lacking intentional intergenerational relationships, and that was really the key to long-term social movements. I mean, the quote has been said that the long memory is the most radical, you know, notion in America, right? And we can only have long memories when we have good conversations across generations. And so I really took that to heart. I know a lot of my fellow organizers took that to heart and are intentionally learning from and talking to and building with our movement elders and really being able to move forward based on learning from their experiences, both successful experiences and failures.
And if you walked around the place, there were these walking historical figures. It's like you're running into Al Haber, who really, more than Tom Hayden and anyone, created SDS, right? And Eric Chester, who is a longtime, revolution from below guy. But every place you went, you were running, Grace Lee Boggs, for God's sake. She's like 95, but one of the great, bottom-up community organizers, and she was speaking there as well.
And had her birthday party there, in fact, which was really great. I mean, from a big names of a movement elder perspective, I spent a lot of time in the TGI Justice Project with Miss Major, who is a African-American trans woman who was at the Stonewall Rebellion.
Wow.
And is still actively That's organizing awesome. Young trans women of color in the Bay Area who are engaged in the street economy. And so it's just really great to be able to sit with somebody who has that much historical knowledge and who is still just like on the same level with you and just really wants to build for justice.
And it really was a who's who of the anti-nuke movement in America. And I love the anti-nuke people because they're always fighting against large corporate nukes, so they hardly ever fight against themselves. And they reorganized their panels so they could all meet together. And there was a lot of young people that were in there, just as passionate and really for civil disobedience. So the nuke movement, if you wanted to meet anyone who has ever done anything in the nuke movement from the beginning, including Harvey Wasserman, to these young kids that are still sitting down, in front of Bulldozer. That was the place to be.
I mean, I have a big, activist crush on Bernadine Dorn, who walked past us.
Yeah, everyone in the place. See, that's intergenerational, because I became a radical in part because of Bernadine Dorn. I used to try to find where her safe house was in Detroit in 1969.
I guess the people that I had never met before that I got a chance to meet were kind of like people who were younger and organizations who had just recently begun in the past decade. And to me, one that stands out would be Insight Women of Color Against Violence and the Philly Stands Up Collective, and also the Prison Abolition Group.
Oh, Critical Resistance.
Critical Resistance, yeah. They were all three of the most radical, amazing groups that I've looked up to in the past decade and followed what work that they're doing, and to be able to meet them in person and meet all of the other groups that have started all across the country and all the groups that were inspired by their work and everything that's come from the past, like, a few years to a decade or a longer, and just have everyone together and see how much it's grown and see how much we can still influence each other and creating broader networks of these kind of these organizations or these struggles and creating connections. It was just amazing to just meet people from these smaller groups that are doing things that are sort of newer ideas and newer approaches to what's going on in the world.
Yeah, and I went to the Native American Indian Center on the southwest side of Detroit, which was
cool. Incredible.
And the one thing I noticed, I'm the legal counsel here for the Native Americans of Central Ohio, which has a long history that goes back to the formation of AIM, which came out of the Cleveland area.
What's AIM?
With money diverted from the government to buy guns. The American Indian movement,
Okay. You
know, the ones that seized Wounded Knee and Leonard Peltier still in jail. I mean, people don't know about Columbus, Ohio, but we got the Lakota from Pine Ridge here. We got the most radical Native Americans in there. But most of the Native Americans I met at the center were interesting because a lot of them were from Central America who had come up because of the revolution to avoid death as part of the sanctuary movement, and some from South America as well. So very militant, very class-based, very active. And I also met a Native American brother who I ate with from Alaska, who, you know, really is fighting against HAARP. I mean, really hates the government's, you know, sort of death ray that they're developing there in Alaska. So great community, very, very friendly.
You know, and Bob, I mean, to kind of dovetail off of something like that class-based things that you're talking about, I mean, I think the part that I really liked about a lot of the organizations that were represented at the social forum is that they all had, you know, quote, radical or revolutionary ideas and movements, and really taking radical to mean its actual, like, root causes, right? And so because they're taking radical to mean, like, the root cause, not only are they pushing forward beyond where we're at now and really envisioning a world beyond capitalism, they're also extremely dedicated to people's material needs, to get a little Marxist, I guess. But, like, they don't want to just say, hey, we need to move forward to the revolution. Screw it if you don't have a sandwich to eat. They're making sure people are actually fed, have housing, and can move forward to build towards a revolutionary movement. Because revolution, in a lot of their minds, and, you know, I really agree with and I'm really excited about, is that revolution is a process, not an endpoint.
Yeah.
And people need to be taken care of and their material needs in that time, too.
I was curious, since there were so many people at the social forum, what kinds of things did you see as far as feeding people, making sure that people had lunch or housing or other, like, first aid? Were there kitchens set up, or how did they distribute the food out to people? I know that we had, like, our local chapter of Food Not Bombs went up. So, but how, on the whole, do they feed 20,000 people?
We can talk about that a little bit, I guess. So there was a couple different ways of doing that. One, there was a track, The World From World From Below, which was an anti-authoritarian track. And they had a national Food Not Bombs collective that fed a large majority of people every single day. They also encouraged... the really great part about this is part of the theory of change of the social forum is that it's bottom-up organized, meaning that people who are directly impacted need to organize for their own, you know, movement. And so cities that had organized delegations to come to Detroit were able to organize their own tents and their own food services. And so they really had a lot of that. And there was just a lot of other kind of coordination where it was needed.
Great. So it sounds like everybody had a great experience at the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit. We also have a lot of events locally going on that people can participate in regularly to stay informed about social justice issues. This weekend and every second Saturday of the month is the Second Saturday Salon with the Free Press. at 1021 East Broad Street. I think it starts about 7. It goes from like about 7 to 11. You can meet progressive activists who focus on election law and a variety of different topics, have some food, and socialize with our activist community here. There's also Food Not Bombs every Sunday at 5 o'clock at the Sporeprint Info Shop, 172 East 5th Avenue. And while you're there, stop by the Third Hand Bicycle Co-op at 174 East 5th Avenue. We also have a local community garden, the Arawak City Gardens, where we grow food for Food Not Bombs. And it's a safe space for poor people in the community to come and grow grow their own food or harvest food that's growing there as we try to build a gift economy in Arawak City.
Kind of build off of some of another event that's coming up. It's a little bit down the road, so I was marking a calendar a little bit early. But August 7th, Saturday, August 7th, starting at 9 o'clock at the Aware House space, which is directly behind the Spore Print, is the August Hootenanny for Hellraisers.
Great, it's always a good time.
Yeah, it's a fun social justice party, and this time around, it's a benefit for Shades, LGBT folks of color.
Great.
And is being co-sponsored by New Leaf, which is a community-wide LGBT group of color that just started here in Columbus.
Great.
We have a fun electronic hip-hop queer-friendly band from New York, Minya, who's coming out. And we also have Spooktober coming up from Athens, Ohio.
Great. August 7th. Yeah, the Aware House is a really great space. Some folks over there got a warehouse, split the rent, and they use it to build tall bikes, to do screen printing, and I mean, a variety of... They have benefit parties. And there was also a cooperative restaurant... the initial kind of party and fundraiser to start a cooperative restaurant there. And I was just so impressed at how great the food was, how professional the service was. And I just couldn't help thinking, geez, I wish this happened more than just once in a while, that we had a community restaurant where people could go and volunteer all the time. So hopefully that's in the works. Do any of you guys know more about that? Are you involved in that at all?
I think that is definitely in the works. It was coming out of a space where we really wanted to see more worker-owned and workplace democracy spaces in Columbus. And so the folks who organized that dinner are now looking at ways of getting a more permanent space set up, and maybe even looking at alternative ways of setting up mobile restaurant spaces.
Yeah, that was just fabulous. I just, you know, I went to that event and I thought, wow, you know, my friends are so cool. You know, this is exactly what we should be doing.
It's all happening.
And, you know, we're able to organize a lot of these projects and work with each other and build a structure in Columbus to start having cooperatives and, you know, to do these, you know, kind of, I guess, different tasks that are really needed to build the world that we want to see.
Again, we urge everyone to stay active, and maybe we can go around real quickly and ask our guests to sum up what's on their mind.
Yeah.
The last word.
And let's say your names.
Yeah. Let's go.
Oh, I'm Stephanie, or June. I kind of have two names. I guess the things that are on my mind right now is Charlie kind of took the words out of my mouth when the thing that I took away from the social forum was definitely that revolution isn't, like, I feel like a lot of times, like, coming from a, like, anti-authoritarian perspective and anti-capitalist perspective, I feel really like, oh man, when are we going to overthrow the state? When are we going to overthrow everything? But, like, seeing it as, like, no, we're, like, already starting to, like, take the power back in our own hands. We're already starting to, like, find ways to not call the cops when one of our friends is assaulted. We're, you know, looking for ways to, like, exchange, like, mental health and health services, which I saw the Rock Dove Collective, which everyone should check out. And yeah, so it was really exciting to, like, see the revolution happening now, not something that, like, we might see in 40 years.
This is Charlie. I'm with the Judy Berry Housing Collective. And I'm really excited to be coming back to Columbus after Social Forum and intentionally working on white anti-racist mobilizations for justice.
I'm Meg, and I'm with the Community Accountability Action Collective, which is a transformative justice survivor support and abuser accountability group here in Columbus. And we're a small collective right now, but it was really inspiring to go to the U.S. Social Forum and have all of these different models that have worked and people who are working currently.
Thank you so much for being our guests. This has been Fight Back with Bob Patrakis and Connie Goodell Newton.
Instead of working
CRS,
with
peace.
The prison system, the criminal justice system in general. So it was great in learning just what June was saying, how like while we are trying to just tear down and take apart these parts of the system that are failing a lot of people, we're at the same time creating alternatives in its place. So we're actually trying to build our own stronger communities and tearing down the system.